Thanks, worship team. I love that set of songs. I haven't heard From the Inside Out in ages. It's great. Thanks for leading us. If you are a child up through sixth grade, we invite you to continue worship. Following Angie and I don't know who else. Yeah, thanks. Okay. We, as Andy mentioned, we are in the middle of a series in Daniel, marching through, walking through. And if you have a Bible, you're going to want to go ahead and grab one. I have no slides for you. I do this. Sometimes I have lots of slides. Sometimes I have a whiteboard. Sometimes I've got nothing at all. Today, nothing at all for you. So grab a Bible. We have some actually in the back if you want to slip up and grab one there. We are going to be in Daniel 6, and we are going to be talking about politics a little bit. It's going to get a little political. Daniel, because Daniel has a lot to say. But you maybe have heard, you know, hey, should church talk about politics? And the answer is yes and no. It depends on what you mean. So should the church talk about politics? No, in the sense that a church really shouldn't be telling you, hey, here's the guy you need to vote for. These are the things you need to do and in specificity. That, no. In that sense, and that's usually what people mean when they say keep politics out of church. But in another sense, it is inescapable that a church has to involve itself in politics. And it all depends on how you view politics. So the word politics comes from polis, and that simply means citadel, city, or community. So a working definition of a polis, it's an account of how we live in common with neighbors. It's how we structure relationships with each other, how we do that, how we've agreed to live alongside. And America is this spot where a diversity of opinions, you live next door to people who think very differently from you, and you aren't hacking each other with swords, right? We live in a place, a polis, that is set up in a particular way, that functions a particular way. So for us, right, we have shared spaces, knowing that we don't believe what others believe, we don't love what others love, and we don't hope for and await things that other people hope for and await. We like to have nice, clean borders, though, don't we? You know, this is where I do my church stuff. This is where we'd have academics and this. And this is civic life and where we vote and do these things. Life just doesn't exist that way. There's blurring and bleeding between these spheres, if you will. It doesn't exist. So the church is a political reality, and the state itself is religious. And that bleeds through at times where the civic state, and in Daniel we see this very often, that the state imposes worship and forms worship. Even ours, in the place that we live in America, there are things that the civic government is trying to form your heart of worship towards. And then on the other way around, a church, what we do here is a political reality. The way that we do life with each other functions a certain way, and that is politics. How we've agreed to give grace to each other in Christian community, to love each other. When hard things happen, not to ignore them, but to expose sin and walk through those things together. We have a political reality that exists within this culture here. James K.A. Smith has written this a handful of things about the church and politics, and this quote I just find so compelling. He says, "So long as the church preaches the gospel and functions as a properly political reality with a policy of her own, the kings of the earth have a problem on their hands. As soon as the church appears, it becomes clear to any alert politician that worldly politics is no longer the only game in town. The introduction of the church into any city means that the city has a challenger within its walls." There is conflict between the church that says, give you all to Jesus, all of you, all of worship, and at the same time, we live in a culture that does not agree with that, and there's conflict. And what James K. Smith points out is that anyone who's given their life to Christ and functions the way a church ought to function in preaching the gospel, preaching who Jesus is, creates conflict. Now, we see this in Daniel again and again and again. This is a thing that happens. Babylon is this superpower that has come in and kind of conquered Jerusalem and Israel, taken over. And yet, as you read Daniel, you realize who's really in power here, who's really in control. Babylon cannot swallow Israel, can't do it. It's tried to, and now it's not sitting well in the stomach and has to come back up. The faith of the Israelites has more power. That's a thing that pops again and again and again. That faith, too, shines all the brighter because it's been placed in a position of weakness. You have Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, who are really in a place of powerlessness when it comes to their faith, their God, because they've been conquered. And yet, you watch their faith blow up the way the world functions. And in each of the stories, you notice that the glory of God spreads throughout the whole empire because of the faith of these guys. What I noticed is that the story of Daniel, the story of Israel as it goes into exile and returns eventually back into Israel, is really, it follows the story of the Ark of the Covenant. So the Ark of the Covenant in the Old Testament is this box where the Lord has decided, I'm going to reside in this box. And maybe it sounds a little sacrilegious to call it a box. The Ark of the Covenant, right? In this Ark, he says, I live in this Ark in a special way with my people. And that represented relationship. That represented his power being with them. The trouble is, Israel began to take it like a rabbit's foot, hey, we've got God on our side, and we can do what we want. And in the middle of some wars, they began to lose. They forgot to take the ark with them. They became kind of dependent on God in a sense where we can live our life however we want, and God's still going to fight our battles for us. And what they did was they lost some battles, so they're like, oh, man, we got to bring the ark out. When we bring the ark out, then we're going to win. And so they come bringing this ark in this uproar, and the enemy begins to quiver. Like, oh, shoot, God is now here. We're going to lose. And that's not what happens. Israelites get slaughtered. And the enemy takes the Ark of the Covenant back with them as this victory of conquering. And as the enemy takes it, this parallels what's going on in Babylon. As they take the ark, they can't handle the ark. And the ark forces them to realize that the God of Israel is in charge. The god Dagon ends up bowing prostrate before it, smashed up. Then they start moving the ark from city to city. No one wants this thing because it's causing tumors, causing all kinds of things, because it still has with it the presence of God. And eventually, the ark, all on its own, returns to Israel. That is the story of Israel as well. The presence of God. The Israelites themselves had betrayed God, had not walked in relationship with him, had done just whatever they wanted, and just assumed God would be all right with that. And God allowed them, after warning and warning and warning, allowed them to be taken into exile. And yet, while they're in exile, just like the ark did this crazy stuff to blow up the way they were doing things, we see that happen again and again in the story. So we're going to see some of those dynamics play out with the knowledge that they will return. God will bring them back in an incredible way. So we're going to start in Daniel chapter 6. And if you wouldn't mind actually standing with me in honor of the word, I'm going to just walk through this piece by piece. We'll just read the first 5 verses right now. It says this: it seemed good to Darius to appoint 120 satraps over the kingdom, that they would be in charge of the whole kingdom, and over them 3 commissioners, of whom Daniel was one, that these satraps might be accountable to them and that the king might not suffer loss. Then this Daniel began distinguishing himself among the commissioners and satraps because he possessed an extraordinary spirit, and the king planned to appoint him over the entire kingdom. And the commissioners and satraps began trying to find a ground of accusation against Daniel in regard to government affairs. But they could find no ground of accusation or evidence of corruption, inasmuch as he was faithful, and no negligence or corruption was to be found in him. Then these men said, we will not find any ground of accusation against this Daniel unless we find it against him with regard to the law of his God. Let me pray. Lord, would you open our hearts and our ears to hear the truth of this passage? Would it sink deep into our souls? And I pray that you'd be honored as we study it. Amen. You can have a seat. So what we're going to do is I'm just going to take it chunk by chunk. I want us to live this story a little bit and to draw out, as we go through it, political realities of how the church is to operate, pull out different truths. And in the end, I want to show us how this story showcases the gospel. It's designed in a way to help you see the story of Jesus. But we begin with a king who is interested in bringing order and control over his government. So 120 satraps. I actually had to look it up, like, how do you pronounce this? And I saw, actually, you can pronounce it satraps or satraps. Either of them is fine. I thought at first I was saying it wrong. But you're fine. Apparently, you could say it a couple of different ways. But these satraps are provincial governors. And the king is interested in bringing control and order over the empire. And what you notice in the book is that Daniel begins to be distinguished. He's a standout. And I love that as he's looking over the empire, there's something that rises to the surface. Daniel gets his eyes. One of the core values at Center Church of the nine is we believe excellence honors God and inspires people. Excellence honors God and inspires people. I think that's what we're seeing in this passage. And I love that we're a church that speaks excellence into being and that notes and recognizes. So I thought it'd be great just to take a couple moments for you to share. What excellence do you see in the church? What excellence do you see in each other? And give you a brief moment to be able to recognize that and give it up. Yeah. That's good. Yeah. Thanks, worship team. That's a lot of hours you guys put in. Appreciate that. It's excellence. What else do you notice? Who do you want to call out? Yeah, Greg. DC groups, yeah. Mm-hmm.
I find that inspiring.
Yeah. We go deep. We like to talk about things that maybe others like to cover up, but man, we don't let that happen. I love that about this church. And we have good leaders who press in, who talk about things, go to the depth. Yeah. I appreciate Tim. Tim Gale, a guy who's excels so well at loving people and giving them second chances. Your heart is so, I see that time and again, that you're the one who advocates for others, and it's inspiring. For me to, like, oh man, I love that. So there's so many things, right, that happen within a church where that happens. So I want you to think for a second, are you distinguished? You know, in the cream of the crop, are you someone who's distinguishing yourself, someone who rises to the surface? Do you lean towards doing the bare minimum of what's required? Do you care about the little things at your job? I remember going on a fall retreat with crew, and one of the toilets at the campsite was clogged up, and it was a nasty mess. I mean, it had spilled over. It was just a nasty mess. And so the students were, of course, came to the director at the time and said, hey, like, this is dirty. We got to do something about this. The team leader came in and saw the mess, and for some reason, the campsite wasn't really available at the time. And my thought was like, oh, you know, just let them deal with this. But this team leader, the guy who's in charge of like running the whole weekend, organizing the events, talking with people, he took it upon himself to like, well, this toilet needs to be unclogged, and unclogged the toilet, cleaned it up, and I was like, wow, that sticks. To watch someone do something with excellence where it was like, hey, I could just, you know, shut this off, but to watch that happen, that was something else. There was something different about Daniel that distinguished him from the others. And the text says that he had an extraordinary spirit. There's something about a movement of trusting in the Spirit's power in your life. It's not like you have to be excellent and superior and like develop incredible skills. I think it comes simply from trusting the Lord to work in your heart and then diligently doing whatever's in front of you and the Spirit working in you. The king trusts Daniel to give him a level of power. And I think that if you're faithful in little, God will give you more responsibility. He will grant it. That the story of the talents being given out, where the guy gives out, you know, different types of talents, when they come back and he says, well done, good and faithful slave, you have been faithful in little, I will put you over much. There's a sense that God loves to see what we're going to do with the little responsibilities that we have. I look at my life and I'm like, I've got way too many responsibilities. But the time spent in the little things that are important matter. Okay, so in this story, though, as someone excels, someone else is looking and doesn't like what's happening, right? So there's these other guys who notice Daniel rising to the top, and they, rather than buckling down and becoming excellent themselves, they want to tear him down. They want to knock him out. So what they do is they try to find any ground of accusation against Daniel, and they do a moral audit. So I don't know what this looks like, but they are researching, investigating, trying to find skeletons in the closet. They're doing whatever they can to find something, some level of corruption, because everyone's got a skeleton, right? Everyone's got something that can be found, and yet he's beyond reproach completely. They can find nothing. No bribes, no embezzlement, no faulty scales, shady business deals, nothing. Zilch. They can find nothing on Daniel, and they realize they must come up with a different strategy to get after him. But notice, the king recognizes excellence when he sees it. Excellence, there's two kind of concepts. One, it's doing your job well, whatever you're responsible for, doing it well and doing it righteously. Doing it the best of your ability and doing it morally before God. All right, so that's the context. Now, in the next section, we've got the trap being set. In 6 through 13. Then these commissioners and satraps came by agreement to the king and spoke to him as follows. King Darius, live forever. All the commissioners of the kingdom, the prefects and the satraps, the high officials and the governors have consulted together that the king should establish a statute and enforce an injunction that anyone who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days shall be cast into the lion's den. Now, O king, establish the injunction and sign the document so that it may not be changed according to the laws of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Therefore, King Darius signed the document, that is, the injunction. Now, when Daniel knew that the document was signed, he entered his house. Now in his roof chamber, he had windows open toward Jerusalem. And he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Then these men came by agreement and found Daniel making petition and supplication before his God. Then they approached and spoke before the king about the king's injunction. Did you not sign an injunction that any man who makes a petition to any god or man besides you, O king, for 30 days is to be cast into the lion's den? The king replied, the statement is true according to the law of the Medes and the Persians, which may not be revoked. Then they answered and spoke before the king. Daniel, who is one of the exiles from Judah, pays no attention to you, O king, or to the injunction which you signed, but keeps making his petition three times a day. All right, so the trap is set, it's sprung, and here we have Daniel being put in a position where he has to make a decision. And it all begins with a lie. They come to the king and say, all the commissioners, all the satraps, all the leaders of the land have come in agreement. That's not actually true. Daniel, if he was aware of this, would not have been in agreement with this. They have left out the particular parties that this concerns, but they come to him and say, everyone's on board. This is going to be fantastic. Sign this thing. And notice the text repeats this again and again. The law is irrevocable. Once set on the books, it cannot be changed. This is just how the Persians do things. If you read the book of Esther, this same thing happens again, where King Ahasuerus signs this decree to wipe out the Israelites. I mean, the Jewish race, he puts in the law that there's going to be this day where that happens. When he finds out that he was tricked, he does not change the law. He cannot change the law. And so he instead cleverly overcomes that by adding another law over top of that law. The law is the law, and it's firm. And the text wants you to see that. How does Daniel respond? Notice what he does. When this law, this immovable rock kind of happens, what does Daniel do? In verse 10, it says he continued kneeling on his knees three times a day, praying and giving thanks before his God, as he had been doing previously. Observe that he continued kneeling. It does not say that he stopped kneeling, nor does it say that he started kneeling. He continued kneeling. This is important. He didn't stop kneeling. That means Daniel did not allow the government to dictate his worship. He would not allow that to impact his worship of God. He knew that there was a place where there's an overstepping of bounds, and that is where the government cannot tell you who or what to worship. Is an overstepping of the authority. And Daniel is willing to give up a lot. Think of all that Daniel's given up. He's given up his language. When he and the boys show up, they have to relearn language. They have to learn all the history of the Babylonian Empire. So academically, they're learning this whole new culture. Gave up their names. We talked today about dead naming, if you've changed your name. They take on. Daniel has given up a lot, but there's a line in the sand. There is a line that is not to be crossed, and Daniel will, while he gives up a lot of things, he will not give up his worship of the Lord. He knows not to do that. But he also doesn't begin to hide his faith, right? Now, he could be like, Daniel, why didn't you just move your prayer from the window into a prayer closet? You can still pray and worship God. Why not hide your faith? Notice he doesn't stop doing that either. He decides, I will keep doing what I have been doing. You can put whatever law you want on the books, but my heart belongs to the Lord. So he doesn't stop kneeling, but he also doesn't start kneeling. He doesn't move from the prayer closet to the window. He's not interested in creating an offensive thing. He doesn't go out on the streets and start praying out where it's totally obvious and interruptive of other people. He is not interested in starting to do something that he didn't begin. His faith was always public and would continue that way. So we see in Daniel this continuing in faith. And we need to have that kind of resolution as well, where whatever the government asks of you, there must be a line in the sand somewhere where you say, no, this is where an overstepping has happened. All right, so the king discovers that he has been tricked. So we'll pick up the story in 14 through 20. Then as soon as the king heard this statement, he was deeply distressed and set his mind on delivering Daniel. And even until sunset, he kept exerting himself to rescue him. Then these men came by agreement to the king and said to the king, "Recognize, O king, that it is a law of the Medes and Persians that no injunction or statute which the king establishes may be changed." Then the king gave orders, and Daniel was brought in and cast into the lion's den. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Your God, whom you constantly serve, will himself deliver you." A stone was brought and laid over the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring. And with the signet rings of his nobles so that nothing would be changed in regard to Daniel. Then the king went off to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no entertainment was brought before him, and his sleep fled from him. Then the king arose at dawn, at the break of day, and went in haste to the lion's den. When he had come near the den to Daniel, he cried out with a troubled voice. The king spoke and said to Daniel, "Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you constantly serve, been able to deliver you from the lions?" So Darius is in this pickle. And I'd love to do a little would you rather with you, because that's kind of the situation. So if you wouldn't mind standing up, everyone, stand up. We're going to do a couple would you rathers. This is a warm-up one, okay? Would you rather, the first question is, would you rather be stuck, would your life be stuck in the Barbie movie or in the Oppenheimer movie? So stay standing if you would prefer the Oppenheimer movie. Sit down if you would prefer your life to be stuck in the Barbie movie. To be completely honest, I haven't seen them either. But I tell you, I would sit down. My life would be stuck in Barbie. So from what you know, all right, Oppenheimer, that's where we're going? Majority of you are going Oppenheimer? Why? Okay, you just hate Barbie that much. My decision's totally color schemes. Oppenheimer seems like so drab. Barbie, like, I could do the neon, that's fine. I could do the neon colors and the leg warmers, that's okay with me. Okay, split. All right, okay, that's just a warm-up one. Everyone stand up again. Would you rather have unlimited free Wi-Fi everywhere you go, but constant intrusive ads? That's the one side. Or never have to charge your electronic devices, but they can only be used for 10 minutes at a time. They're both horrible options, right? All right, I'll read it again. So free Wi-Fi everywhere, anywhere you go. It's free, constant, but pop-up ads. Consistent pop-up ads. You're just dealing with that. The other is you never have to charge your devices ever. They're constantly charged wherever you go, but you can only use them for 10 minutes at a time. Oh, yeah, I should clarify. Second one is sit down. So you guys are all choosing 10 the 10 minutes? We're all going with 10 minutes? Why is that? Ads are so terrible. They're just so abysmal. Laura, why pick the other? Oh, yeah, you already live with ads. So big deal. Wi-Fi everywhere? That's amazing. Yeah. Yeah, there's pop-up filters. No, you wouldn't be able to use pop-up filters, though. That's the trick. All right, last one. Stand up. So if you pick the first one, stay standing. If you want the second one, sit down. Would you rather live in a world where all transportation is replaced by self-driving vehicles that are constantly malfunctioning? Or a world where all food is replaced by a nutritionally perfect meal that's a replacement shake that tastes like cardboard? All travel standards are all travel, but they malfunction. Automated versus food. All your food is a shake that's perfectly healthy. You guys are standing? Yeah? You just love food. You're giving up food. You'd ride a horse? No, all transportation. You can't do a horse either. What do you think, Jack? You'd rather, you're fine with the cardboard drinks? That's true. That's true, yes. Okay. All right, well, thanks. You can sit down. Would you rather, right? Would you rather works because there are two impossible circumstances, right? You don't want to choose between either of those. We want to find a way to navigate between them. Darius, I love that this text actually moves away from a focus on Daniel to Darius himself. King Darius is stuck between a rock and a hard place, right? He loves Daniel. When he hears this news, his heart sinks down into his feet. Just imagine hearing some devastating piece of news, and maybe you already have. I had a friend text me the other day. He said Max was in a pretty serious motorcycle accident Friday. Not life-threatening, no paralysis, but he injured his left leg severely. Dislocated hip, chipped ball and socket, broke tibia and fibula. He's still in the hospital. We think he'll come home tomorrow. Now when, I mean, motorcycle against anything else, I mean, motorcycle's gonna lose, right? They did not have that information. The hospital or, I forget who notified them, but all that they were told is your son was in a terrible motorcycle accident, and that was all that they said. He's at this hospital. And for 30 minutes, they knew nothing about the condition of their son. You can believe that your whole life squeezes down to one thing at that moment, and one thing only. This is that for Darius. Darius realizes what he's done, the law he's put on the books, and realizes Daniel is dead. And there's no way out of this situation. But he does begin to look for loopholes. He knows he can't change the law, so he begins to find, can I find the place to navigate between these two horrible, impossible realities? He's exerting his energy. And, you know, Darius is a king. He's got all kinds of things available at his fingertips, and he cannot figure out a way through this. He's using all that's available. He's fighting for this guy. And he's doing this so much, putting in so much effort. Notice that the commissioners are all like, oh, we need to remind this king, like, hey, you can't change this law. Because they're beginning to wonder if he's actually going to choose the other impossible side, which is to revoke an irrevocable law. Darius has to choose. He rather release Daniel, or rather on the other side is to uphold the law. He loves Daniel. He's pulling everything. He wants to undo the trick. However, he's legally obligated to uphold the stipulations of the law. To revoke it would be to tear down the whole political system. And it is the political system that helped put Babylon on the map, the way that they function, the way they do things. To change the law would actually, if he were to do that, it would call into question his own political authority and maybe even end in his kingship. There is no way out. And he chooses to follow the law and put Daniel in the lion's den. He gives the order, and Daniel is punished for the worship of God. The king places his trust, though, in Daniel's God. He says, your God, Daniel, your God will rescue you. You kind of wonder why. Why would Darius place his trust in a God that he doesn't? I think when you have your back against the wall, you begin looking for any answer, any solution, and he has none. So he's throwing the Hail Mary. He is looking for the outlandish way of looking at this. What I'm not able to do, maybe your God can. What I don't have the power to do, maybe your God can. But notice it's also a shaky trust at best. If you truly trusted in God, you would not have been spending the night in anguish. And some people like to portray Darius in his sleep that night versus Daniel and portray it as Daniel sleeping amongst these billowy, pillow-like lions and resting super well, while Darius is up all night just in anxiety, right? So Darius, as he tries to place his trust in God, it's a shaky trust. He even shows up and like, Daniel, did your God do it? Like, did he rescue you? It is a trust that is a baby-like trust in the God of Daniel. But this is what pops. The king of Babylon, the strongest superpower of the world, Darius is not able to do a thing. He's helpless, has very little hope. But the king of Israel can do the impossible. Darius has to acknowledge his weakness and then on the other side recognize what God is able to do. So we'll read the conclusion here. 21. Then Daniel spoke to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel and shut the lion's mouths, and they have not harmed me. Inasmuch as I was found innocent before him, and also toward you, O king, I have committed no crime. Then the king was very pleased and gave orders for Daniel to be taken up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he had trusted in his God. The king then gave orders, and they brought those men who had maliciously accused Daniel, and they cast them, their children, and their wives into the lion's den. And they had not reached the bottom of the den before the lions overpowered them and crushed all their bones. Then Darius the king wrote to all the peoples, nations, and men of every language who were living in all the land, "May your peace abound. I make a decree that in all the dominion of my kingdom, men are to fear and tremble before the God of Daniel. He is the living God and enduring forever. And his kingdom is one which will not be destroyed, and his dominion will be forever. He delivers and rescues and performs signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has also delivered Daniel from the power of the lions?" So this Daniel enjoyed success in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian. Notice, right, that it is God who is exalted in a nation and power state where this probably shouldn't happen, but it does, because our God is that powerful. Daniel is found innocent. The verdict comes out, not guilty. He has committed no crime. And the point to pull from this is there are times when disobeying the government is the absolute right thing to do. There are times when going against what your governors or an edict or a law that comes out, where disobeying that is the right thing to do. When you do it for the sake of honoring God, you also will receive the same verdict of innocence. Innocence and having done the absolute right thing. Now, I want to caution, as we say that boldly, caution on the other side is we're also called to obey our civil authorities and leaders. On the whole, we ought to follow cheerfully those who are above us. That means, right, drive the speed limit. Drew, is he in here? Yeah, right, we got a resident cop. Drive the speed limit, right? I'm learning all kinds of things that are legal and illegal according to the law. Through him, but drive the speed limit. And at those points, you live in a culture where most, you don't need to disobey the government. If you live somewhere else, that friction you're going to feel up close and personal. And there may come a day where you feel that rub, and maybe you already have in certain contexts. But our culture cares a lot about being on the right side of history. We say that phrase. The trouble with being on the right side of history is there's ways to frame it. And if you wait 20 years, what was on the right side of history today may be different from what's going to be there in the future. We care a lot, and the Bible gives us very clear indication you can be on the right side of history because his verdict will come down. And if you honor him and glorify him and worship him, even when it looks like you're guilty, there will be a verdict of innocence. Justice is served in the end, and God, the God who delivers, is made known to the world. So the church acts as a challenge to the pure authority of the civic state. And it is these small moments where you draw the line and go against. And I want to end just a couple observations. I want to look at two more passages about how this story teaches us the gospel of Jesus. And nestled in it is God and how he rescues you and me. So two ways that happens. First is that God is pictured in Darius as a God who's in the same predicament, if we can call it a predicament. But God is stuck between a rock and a hard place. So God is a God of justice, where the edict of God, right? When Darius writes a law, it's encoded. Well, God doesn't just write arbitrary laws that he wishes he didn't write. He is a God of justice. So the laws are the laws, not because of some arbitrary reason, but because they express a justice. So every sin must have its full and right penalty. That means, because we've all sinned, the Bible teaches, that we have all fallen short, and that the penalty for sin is death. That means all of us must die in eternal separation from God. So that's the one side. If God is going to be just, and he is, he must choose this. On the other hand, he's also a God of mercy who loves us, wants to redeem us. You see this in Darius? There's this in between, how can we do this? How can we make this happen? And which would God choose? And our God does what Darius can't. Between these two impossible choices, he does both things simultaneously. He upholds the law perfectly and yet saves sinners. And all through that, he kind of tears down the power structures of the day. So if you go to Colossians 2, we get a picture of this happening in Colossians 2. In verse 8, it says, "See to it that no one takes you captive through philosophy and empty deception, according to the tradition of men, according to the elementary principles of the world, rather than according to Christ. For in him all the fullness of deity dwells in bodily form, and in him you have been made complete. And he is the head over all rule and authority, and in him you were also circumcised with a circumcision made without hands, in the removal of the body of the flesh by the circumcision of Christ, having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised up with him through faith in the working of God, who raised him from the dead. When you were dead in your transgressions and the uncircumcision of your flesh, he made you alive together with him, having forgiven us all our transgressions, having canceled out the certificate of debt consisting of decrees against us, which was hostile to us, and he has taken it out of the way, having nailed it to the cross. When he had disarmed the rulers and authorities, he made a public display of them, having triumphed over them through him." Do you notice this? There was a decree against us. We are in that spot. We're in that spot where there's an irrevocable law laid down that is against you, that is against me. But God's rule is above all. He is above all rule and authority. And he pays that debt. It's not like he says, "I'm going to waive the debt," right? That would be choosing the one side over the other. He doesn't do that. He says, "I will pay the debt so that the balance equates and justice. I'm a God fully and completely a God of justice." But he does it by bearing our punishment for us. He threads the needle in a way that Darius can't do himself. And in that, he also disarms the rulers and authorities. He makes a public display of them. That means he exposes all the world powers for the powerlessness that they are. It's a shaming thing. It's an exposure of all. As mighty as America is, as mighty as Babylon is, as mighty as the Russian, Chinese governments are, Jesus exposes in a ridiculous way how they're utterly powerless. The power of any empire over you is a funny one. It looks so mighty and so powerful. But once Jesus shows up and exposes it, there's nothing there because it's a derivative power. They only have power because God gives them and grants them power. And one day, the true exposure is going to happen. That's the theme in Daniel. Worship God and allow him to expose the ridicule. But notice, right, we're put in this place where there's this ridicule of, like, there's really no power there outside of God granting you that. And at the same time, us being called to honor that authority. You catch that? You do simultaneously recognize its total weakness, and on the other side, you obey it because God has asked you to obey it. Jesus follows the course of this story. Jesus exemplifies everything that Daniel did. Jesus, like Daniel, was a man of excellence, but he's better than Daniel because he's never once gone against God, his Father. He's never once sinned in his life. He is the man par excellence. Jesus, like Daniel, as he exposed the leadership in the time period, they felt threatened, didn't they? They felt threatened that this was this guy who was disrupting the way we do life, the religious system that was built up, and they begin to figure out a way to betray him and to put him to death. Jesus, like Daniel, was found guilty and then was sealed himself in a tomb. Daniel never dies. He goes in the tomb, sleeps with these lions, and comes out. Jesus enters a tomb dead. And we're going to be celebrating that he comes out of that victorious, which is the last. Jesus, like Daniel, emerges victorious and is proven innocent. You see how the story perfectly shows how God navigates between these two things that Darius deals with, and then very precisely shows us the gospel. This is our hope, your hope, not in any worldly power, but in a God who loves you so much he would do what it takes to get you in a spot of being righteous before him. The last verse I just want to read as we close in prayer is Matthew 27, 62 through 66, which says, on the next day, the day after the preparation, the chief priests and the Pharisees gathered together with Pilate and said, "Sir, we remember that he was still alive, that the deceiver said, 'After 3 days, I am to rise again.' Therefore, give orders for the grave to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal him away and say to the people, 'He has risen from the dead.' And the last deception will be worse than the first." Pilate said to them, "You have a guard. Go and make it as secure as you know how." And they went and made the grave secure. And along with the guard, they set a seal on the stone. Let's pray. Lord, we recognize that as you were sealed in that tomb, there was nothing that that whole empire of power could do to keep you there, to hold you there, to lock up all that you are. We celebrate the fact that you allowed yourself to die, you allowed yourself to go into darkness, only to emerge victorious. Lord, our hope is placed in that you are a God who came and died for us and rose from the grave. Lord, would our hearts sing with that kind of hope and trust in you? Lord, that as we live in a world that does life differently, Lord, that our hope in you and our trust in you would supersede that. Lord, would you build our faith in such a way that we wouldn't be unafraid to take a different step, to not be completely like our culture. I thank you for Daniel and the message that it presents to us. Well, ultimately, we thank you for your son who gave his life. We praise you and we honor and we glorify you. Amen.